Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes with you every Saturday afternoon here on News Talk 580 KMJ and online at kmjnow.com. You know what this show is all about. Each week we visit with World War II veterans, and our purpose is threefold. We want to honor them for their service, their sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories for future generations. And along the way, maybe the rest of us can be inspired by the legacy that's been given to us by members of the greatest generation. We call this show Hometown Heroes because the theory is no matter where you live in this great country of ours, there's a hero in your hometown, and you probably don't know what he did to produce the freedom that we enjoy every day. Normally, the guests on this show are people you've never heard of. This week, an exception to the rule. Baseball Hall of Famer Monty Irvin joins us from the greater Houston area in Texas. Mr. Irvin, thanks so much for being with us today.
It's my pleasure, Paul.
Now, you're 91 years old.
Yeah, five months from 92.
What keeps you going and what keeps you so young?
I have family here. 2 years ago, I lost my wife. We were living in Florida. I had been there for 22 years, and then when my wife passed away, my daughter said, come on over Dad to Houston so that my husband and I and the kids can take care of you. And I welcome that opportunity and seize upon the chance to be here.
Well, they haven't made an Astro fan out of you yet, have they?
Well, yeah, I've been going. I'm still, a big Giant fan, of course. I just retired my number there in San Francisco. I went out for the ceremony.
That's right. I was going to ask you about that.
It's a good thing. It was great.
Now, you started playing ball pretty early, and you talk about family. You're from a pretty big family. You're the third youngest of 11 children?
Oh, we were 13.
13 children?
Yeah, I had six sisters and six brothers. So I was the third youngest. And out of that group, there's only three of us living. My youngest brother, who lives in Greensboro, he'll be 86 this year, and I have another brother in New Jersey, Chatham, New Jersey, and he's 88. He'll be 89 in December, so we're getting there.
Well, how much of your athletic prowess do you think can be traced back to chasing your big brothers around?
Well, we all got started because my father was a great baseball fan. And then I had a brother about 10 years older than me. His name was Bob Irvin, Robert C. Irvin.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a pitcher, threw as hard as anybody. And I remember a team came through one year, and they saw him pitch, and they wanted to sign him. Of course, he was living at home. He went and said, Mom, he said, there's a team interested in my playing with him. Is it okay? She said, yeah, it's okay as long as they don't play on Sunday. So he said, Mom, Sunday is the biggest day. She said, no, if they play on Sunday, you can't go because it's a sin to play baseball on Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
So then, later on he got married, of course. And 10 years later, I came along. And by then she had changed her mind and she encouraged us to play and get as good as we could be. And consequently, I had a brother, my brother in North Carolina, Cal Irvin. He became a great shortstop. And but at that time, the money in the Negro League wasn't very much. So he said, since I don't have your power, I think I better go on to college and get a degree and start to teach and coach. And that's what he did. He was an athletic director at A&T College in Greensboro, North Carolina. And my other brother went to Virginia State. He was a football player. So we were an athletic family. And then I had two nephews. One went to Morgan State College in Baltimore, and the other one went to Rutgers University in New Jersey. So there's a lot of athleticism, in my family.
No
question. And I still have some nieces and nephews that are playing today.
I believe it. And and I'm sure if someone put a bat in your hand, you wouldn't be afraid to take a whack either.
I could show them how to do it.
We're talking to Baseball Hall of Famer.
Except my head can't run.
Yeah, that's that, at 91, we understand. This is Monty Irvin, Baseball Hall of Famer. Now, you mentioned New Jersey. You were born in Alabama, moved to New Jersey at a young age, but I guess your time in the South still gave you a taste of an ugly part of our history. How big of a difference was it for you to move north of the Mason-Dixon line and grow up in New Jersey?
The biggest thing is the greatest thing my father ever did was to get us out of there because my older brothers and sisters had very little education. Even though they went to school after, we got to New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
And then, but when we moved there, my father, he stressed on the importance of education. So four of us went to, got a chance to go to college. And that was a blessing. We're still grateful to him for making that big move.
Now, you've been voted by one publication the greatest athlete ever in New Jersey, and I understand at East Orange High you start in football, basketball, baseball, and track. You set a state record in the javelin, too?
In track. That was track. But it wasn't East Orange. It was Orange.
Orange. Oh, is that a rival?
Oranges. Orange, East Orange, West Orange, and South Orange. We lived right in Orange. Later on, I moved to East Orange, but we started in Orange.
Now, I also heard that during this time, as a teenager and starting to star in these different athletic pursuits, you had to overcome a near-fatal illness. What was that all about?
Yeah, I had a streptococcus infection. I got a scratch on my finger playing basketball, and the infection settled in my chest, and I had this wonderful surgeon who found it and operated on me and saved my life. And I was so grateful to him. We remained close friends, good friends, until he passed on. But if he hadn't, I was close to death pretty quick. But he found the infection and gave me about three operations, and I got okay. And that was in February of 1938. And so I had gotten a scholarship to Michigan, University of Michigan, but they didn't think I was going to get well. But not only did I get well, but I recovered and got stronger than I was before. So it didn't deter my football, my athleticism, when I went to Lincoln University in Oxford, PA.
Yeah, sounds like somebody had a better plan for you.
Yeah, that's true.
And you mentioned Lincoln College in Oxford, PA, and you were there and enrolled and competing for them, but at the same time, under a different name, and this really intrigues me, you decided that you were going to be Jimmy Nelson and play for the Newark Eagles in the Negro Leagues. How'd you pull that off?
Well, communications then wasn't what it is now, and you could do it and get away with it. I remember Jim Thorpe and some other guys did the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
In order to, we're still in the Depression at that time, and there was very little money. So I went on, in the summer, I would play with the Eagles. I wouldn't play at home. When we went on the road, I'd play. When we got home, I'd work out with the team and then go sit in the stand. But it gave me a chance to, help out with finances. And then, of course, I only went to Lincoln a year and a half. And because of financial problems, I stopped going to Lincoln and spent full time with the Newark Eagles.
And obviously,
that was in 1939.
And you were clearly at the top of your game. You won a couple of Negro League batting titles.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious, as we think back in the history of the Negro Leagues and some of the great ball players, maybe I can throw out a name and you could give me some quick thoughts about your observations of that player.
Mm-hmm.
Starting with Josh Gibson, was he really the greatest hitter ever?
Greatest hitter I've ever seen. I'm not taking anything away from Hank Aaron and Willie Mays and Joe DiMaggio and Ted Williams and Mickey Mantle and all those other great hitters, Barry Bonds and so on. But this man was a natural. I never seen a swing the kind that he had. He was strong as two men. He weighed about 6'1", around 210, had a rifle for an arm, but he could hit. He could hit, he could run, and he could throw. And every league he ever played in, he won the home run championship and the batting championship. Not only was he a great hitter, but a home run hitter, but he hit for high average. He was something to behold.
Hard to argue with those kind of numbers.
Mm-hmm.
Now, another name, and I won't go all the way through the list, but the guy I'm sure that you had to face, Satchel Paige. What made him so special?
Because he could throw the ball so hard and he had such great control. Plus, he was fearless. He didn't fear anybody. If he said he was going to get you out, he'd get you out. He threw the ball very fast and had great control, and he could almost strike you out when he wanted to. He was something else.
Now,
one of the best pitchers I've ever faced.
And I want to get on with where your story went from there, but before we move on from the Negro League ball players, was there someone, we've heard those famous names like Gibson and Page and Cool Papa Bell. And
Buck Leonard.
Is there someone
John
that
Henry
maybe,
Lloyd.
Mm-hmm. You think there's someone that maybe doesn't get enough attention that you thought was really special?
Oh, yeah. Here of late, they put about 17 guys in about 3 years ago. And his name was Bill Wright, of course. And he was an outfielder, could run like a deer, and good hitter, good fielder, good everything. And then there was a relief pitcher. His name was Webster McDonald, and he lived in Philadelphia. He was a submarine pitcher,
mm-hmm.
And if you saw him, you never would forget him. He made it a habit of beating the major leaguers when they barnstorm.
Right.
Yeah, and of course they just put Dick Lundy was a great shortstop. He's in the mode of. Willie Wells and John Henry Lloyd,
mm-hmm.
And he was just a wonderful person, a great hitter, great fielder, and just a great guy. He managed. He was my first manager when I went to with the Newark Eagles.
You know, and we talk about, you mentioned barnstorming, and that's, in those situations, you guys got a chance to see how you stacked up against these major leaguers,
mm-hmm.
and obviously knew you could compete. How
yep.
hard and how frustrating was it for you to realize that you didn't have access to that league?
Well, we were disappointed, and we made some friends with some of the major leaguers, and we told them, we said, why don't you guys talk it up? You know, maybe we could help him win a pennant or a World Series. So they said, well, we'll do what we can, but you know how negative the owners are. I said, well, keep talking, because it's bound to happen one of these days. And sure enough, in 1946, Bob Feller, one of my dear friends, he formed an all-star team, and Satchel Paige formed an all-star team, and they played each other. They broke about even. But it showed everybody, you know, including the scouts, that we could play baseball as well as anybody. All we needed was a chance. And after that, the scouts out there looking for talent signed a lot of the African-American players.
Now, you at one point left the Negro Leagues and went to the Mexican League, won a triple crown there. But I understand, with all the great hitters that you could have looked at to model your game after, it wasn't someone in your league, but it was an Italiano wearing pinstripes that you modeled your swing after. Is that true?
That's true, Joe DiMaggio. I saw him when he broke in with the Yankees in 1936. I was hitting the ball well, but I wasn't hitting the ball a lot to right field. So I want to, you know, being a right-handed hitter, I wanted to pull the ball, so I used to go there and watch him, and he was a dead pull hitter, and how quick he was, you know, when he was getting the bat around with his follow through, and how graceful he looked at the plate and so on. So in 39, when I went to Daytona Beach for spring training, I practiced hitting the way he did, and by the time spring training was over, I had it. And from 39 on, I became a pretty good hitter, I tell you.
Yeah, 422 is pretty good.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I was tough to strike out. I was strong, you know, naturally strong. And all I needed to do was just get that bat around a little quicker. And with the Joe DiMaggio stance and the fact that, you didn't stride very far, maybe 4 or 5 inches, you could judge the ball and see the ball and be in position to hit a curveball, changeup, or fastball. So it didn't take me long to copy Joe. And later on, I told him about it. He said, "Well, I'm glad somebody thought enough of me to copy my style."
Mm-hmm. Well, it worked pretty well for you, too.
And guess what? Willie Mays did the same thing.
Hey, there you go.
Yeah.
And we're going to talk more about Willie Mays. His signature moment was part of the Giants' crowning achievement in 1954. And, of course, our guest today, Monty Irvin, was there for that as well. He was also there in 1951 when a Scotsman named Bobby Thompson capped one of the most incredible sports comebacks of all time with the shot heard round the world. Before this program's over this afternoon, we're going to take you back to that moment and listen to Russ Hodges' famous radio call. But first, when we come back, where was Monty Irvin on December 7th, 1941, and what did he do in the Army in World War II? Those answers from the Hall of Famer himself when Hometown Heroes continues next on News Talk 580 KMJ.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. We have Bulldog football coming up, a 4:30 kickoff from Oxford, Mississippi today. Our pregame coverage starts right after this show with Bulldogs Live. Monty Irvin almost played football at the University of Michigan, but he ended up, as I think you know, making his name on the diamond, not on the gridiron. He is a member of the Baseball Hall of Fame. His name is on the wall in Cooperstown, and he has many more experiences than we could ever squeeze into this hour-long program. But none of his adventures in Major League Baseball would have ever occurred if he hadn't made it home from his tour of duty in World War II. Before we talk about the 1954 World Series or the shot heard round the world in 1951 or anything that he did in baseball, we're going to delve into World War II through his eyes. So, Mr. Irvin, thanks again for being with us from Houston today. Why don't we start with this question?
And this is something that I ask every veteran I have on this show, whether they played baseball or not. Everyone seems to have a memory.
Yep.
Of December 7th, 1941. Yep. Do you remember how you heard about the attack on Pearl Harbor?
Standing on second base in Puerto Rico.
Really?
When they announced that the Japanese had attacked Pearl Harbor, and the people started to cheer. So I said to myself, they don't know, what a big problem that's going to be, because everything that came into Puerto Rico came in on a ship.
Mm.
The rice and the beans and everything else. And then 3 weeks, rice and beans tripled. The price of rice and beans tripled down there. And so I definitely will remember, being on second base when I heard that this disastrous thing has occurred.
Yeah, not many people can claim that they were standing on second base at the time.
Yeah.
And then Uncle Sam would get his hands on you. What did it mean to you when you were drafted and you realized that you're going to have to put baseball on hold and go serve?
I did. I had just left Mexico, the MVP down there, won the,
The Triple Crown, right?
I won the home runs and the batting average.
All right.
They had 25 home runs and my batting average was 397. A fellow by the name of Silvio Garcia, a wonderful Cuban player, beat me out by 2 runs for the Triple Crown. But he had started playing down there a month before I got there. So I felt pretty good about it. But I knew that, you had to go. I had a daughter who was only 6 months old. Mm. I didn't want to leave her and my wife. But, Uncle Sam called, saying we had to go. So I got, I was drafted, spent my spring, my training in Fort Belvoir, Virginia, and after about 6 weeks, went on down to Camp Claiborne, Louisiana.
Mm-hmm.
And then in a few months, we caught a troop ship going to England. And it was in the North Atlantic for 19 days, and the North Atlantic can be rough, even in the summertime, but in the wintertime, it's almost impossible. And so in 19 days, we were on that ship in a convoy of 500 ships, and guess what? We didn't lose one ship. out of a convoy of 500. But when we got to Liverpool, we couldn't stand up because of that rocking and roll. Yeah, that was a funny thing.
That would do it to you. And much like baseball was segregated at the time, the military was segregated at this time. And
yeah,
so you were in
tragic.
The 1313th Engineer General Service Regiment?
Yes, uh-huh.
With all African-American soldiers?
Yeah, uh-huh. At the beginning, we had a white officer, and later on, he was replaced by an African-American CO, and then we got two or three other lieutenants. And so we felt, more comfortable, and it was treated a little better. So during in 1944, after they invaded, June 6, 1944, was D-Day,
mm-hmm.
and but we didn't get there until 2 months later. And when we got there, Omaha Beach had been cleaned up. And after staying around the beach for a while, we moved across Paris and settled on the other side. And then mainly our duty then became guard duty. A lot of the Nazi soldiers had surrendered, and there was a problem because there were so many of them. We had it was a chore trying to keep track of all of them. So that's what we mainly did. Until the war was over in Japan.
Now, I did read that your unit, during the Battle of the Bulge, that your unit was assigned not necessarily on the front line, but in reserve and near Reims, France.
That's true.
In the Meuse line and ready to blow up bridges if the order came?
Yeah. We blow up bridges and doing a lot of guard duty of refineries, because we knew that the Nazis needed fuel, so our whole outfit was guarding the fuel depots, and luckily they stopped them, up at the Battle of the Bulge, and they never did get to Reims. But Reims was only about 60, 70 miles away, and if they had broken through, there was going to be some heavy fighting in and around Reims, France. We were so happy that it didn't happen.
Now what? I've read before, and I've interviewed several African-American veterans from World War II who told me about how they were treated overseas and then how they were treated back in the States. Did you notice a difference, and did that time overseas give you a new perspective?
Yes, it did. We were treated better by the natives, by the English and the French and the people from Belgium. We had a lot of problems with our own soldiers, mainly, and why they wanted to, be so, anti. We just couldn't understand it. And then after we came back here, back to the States, we were scorned also, and we couldn't understand why. We were called on to do a job, and we did it. But seemingly, nobody appreciated it. Appreciated enough, to welcome us back home.
Now, while you were overseas, and you mentioned how hard it was to leave your daughter behind, your wife
mm-hmm.
behind.
Yeah.
Was there something that kept you motivated overseas, that kind of kept you focused on what you had to do day in, day out, believing that you would get back?
Yeah, well, we knew, that we had a duty, and we knew that if called on to do combat, we'd do that too, you understand? But mainly, obey the rules and, try to do what you're supposed to get back home safely. And luckily, most of our guys did come back safe and sound. But if we had been called on to do battle, we were ready to do that.
Do you still remember what it felt like to come back home to see your wife, your daughter again?
Yeah, after almost 2 years, it was wonderful to come back home. My daughter, she's about 3 years old. She didn't know her father. We had to get her acquainted and so on. But that was a happy chore because I spent most of my time, you know, with her and my wife, you know, to make up for lost time.
Sure. Well,
so that was the beauty part of coming home.
Well, I'm sure, and on cold nights in France, in a foxhole, you probably weren't thinking I'm going to be a baseball Hall of Famer someday.
No, not at all. In fact, before I went over, I never thought that we'd ever get the chance to, you know, play in the majors.
Mm-hmm.
But after going overseas and, you know, seeing how things were done over there and so on, some of the guys was very happy that they experienced a lot of freedom. And when we came back, the saying was, if they can fight for the country, why can't we play for them? So there was a move afoot, you know, to get us into Major League. I remember Mayor Fiorello LaGuardia had a group, and he was along with Adam Clayton Powell and some other politicians were had that in their minds to do it. But then Branch Rickey signed Jackie Robinson, and so that's
hold on there, because the way I heard it, Branch Rickey wanted to sign you.
He did, and uh-huh. I signed with him. I told him I'd had a hard time, didn't have a chance to play at all over there, and I said, I'll sign with you, but I'll let you know when I'm ready. He said, well, that's great.
And you had some ringing in your ears from all the artillery overseas?
Yeah, I had inner ear problem, and 2 years, you know, it got better, and then I, you know, started to play like I had been playing. So all worked out fine.
Are you glad that it was Jackie Robinson who bore the brunt of some of that?
Well, let me just say this. You know, when Jackie was signed, a lot of us were not envious, or not jealous, but we were envious because, talk about Buck Leonard, Josh, and Josh Gibson and Willie Wells and Ray Danger, some of our real stars, mm-hmm. Cool Papa Bell. If they had started just a little sooner, they were... I call them the old masters, and they were, you know, the best at their position. I just wish they could have seen Satchel when he was in his prime and so on, you know, right on down the line. So, in selecting Jackie, they picked a college-educated person who had gained publicity and notoriety out there at the UCLA. He starred in four sports. He was wasn't the best player, but he was the most adequate person that Branch Rickey could have taken. And then, lo and behold, Jackie improved every year. He became a clutch hitter. He became a real good second baseman. He became very thrilling on the bases. So it shows you that, how... I guess smart that Branch Rickey was by picking Jackie, and we're all grateful and very happy that he did such a great job of pioneering.
Well, and it sounds like one of the reasons you said wait on me is you felt if you were the first one and you weren't 100% that you wouldn't have represented your whole league and whole class and race
true.
Of people.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it worked out just the way it should have.
Worked out just fine. Jackie did a great job. You know, he passed away in 1972. Can't believe that he's been gone that long. But he did one super job. Had to take a lot, but he did. And we're, again, very grateful for the wonderful job that he did.
And his legacy certainly lives on. And you had some moments that were reminiscent of some of Jackie Robinson's greatest base-stealing feats. I want to ask you about that, but let's take a quick break, and we'll come back.
When we come back, we're going to have a little fun. Going to revisit a little history. We're going to take you back to this.
The Giants from the Pellet! The Giants from the Pellet! The Giants from the Pellet!
No, I don't want to confuse you. Monty Irvin is not the guy who hit that famous home run, but he's going to tell us why it got him and another Hall of Famer off the hook. Yes, I'm going to ask him about going from someone not even allowed in Major League Baseball because of the color of his skin to an inductee in Baseball's Hall of Fame. I'll ask him about the Giants retiring his number 20 and about some of his exploits with that number on his back in orange and black. But when we come back, we're going to talk about the shot heard round the world. We will listen to the entire radio play-by-play call that Russ Hodges shared with New York and the entire world back on that unforgettable October day in 1951. If you listen to this show on a regular basis, you know how much I enjoy hearing the unbelievable things that World War II veterans experienced all over the globe. That's what this show's all about. We're not usually talking about baseball history, but today is I guess you would call it a captivating exception to that rule. So I hope that you're enjoying it as much as I am, and do not go anywhere. Hometown Heroes is coming right back on News Talk 580 KMJ.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Bobby hitting at 292. He's had a single and a double, and he drove in the Giants' first run with a long fly to center. Brooklyn leads it 4-2. Hartung down the line at third, not taking any chances. Lofton without too big of a lead at second, but he'll be running like the wind if Thompson hits one. Franklin throws. There's a long shot! I got to be, I believe! The Giants run the pellet! 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 Bobby Thompson hits into the lower deck of the left field stand! The Giants run the pellet! And they're going crazy! They're going crazy!
Russ Hodges with the famous call of Bobby Thompson's shot heard around the world back in 1951. The anniversary of that is coming up next weekend, and lo and behold, the Giants are in a pennant race again. We're talking to a gentleman who was there for that incredible comeback, a team that was 13 games back of the hated Brooklyn Dodgers and won the National League pennant on Bobby Thompson's homer. Mm-hmm. What kind of moment was that for you, Monty Irvin?
Paul, it was 13 and a half games in the middle of August, and it was one of the most memorable home runs ever hit in baseball. And lo and behold, Bob Thompson, who was not only was he my teammate, but he was a good friend, he just passed away about a month ago.
Mm-hmm.
And we all saluted him, of course, and hoped that he lives in peace forever. He was a wonderful person. And he really did. He put an extra $5,000 in our pockets for doing what he did.
That was a lot of money in 1951.
During that ninth inning, we're down 4-1, and I'm the only one that made it out in that rally. And I was hitting third, and Whitey Lockman behind me, he doubled. We were kind of a team. We just loved each other. We try to, with the man in front of you fail, you try to pick him up. And that's what Whitey did. And then they changed pitchers, took Don Newcomb out and brought in Ralph Branca. And then on the second pitch, Bobby hit that home run in the lower stand in left field. Now, guess what? Willie Mays was on deck in case, Bobby didn't come through. But but Bobby did, so he got me off the hook for making the only out, and he got Willie off the hook because he didn't have to come to the plate. And that was, it's like it happened yesterday because it was such a wonderful moment. And then we calmly walk from home plate down to a clubhouse in center field, and people said, nice going, guys. Go get the Yankees tomorrow. So the World Series started the next day. We really didn't have a chance to really enjoy the moment.
Yeah, it doesn't work that way anymore. They give you a little more space.
Yes.
And that did send you to the 51 World Series against the Yankees, and that is when the first all-African-American outfield. You and Hank Thompson had broken in with the Giants together in 49, and now you had this young guy you just talked about, Willie Mays.
Yeah.
All three of you in the outfield at the same time. Did that dawn on you? Was it significant at the time?
No. We weren't concerned with color. We were concerned with content.
Yep, and the Yankees.
It just happened to be that way. DeRozier put the best, the best group out there to catch the ball and to hit the ball. And we didn't think about it until somebody mentioned it to us.
And that was
that was our feeling at the time.
That was your best year in the big leagues. You led the National mm-hmm. League in runs batted in that year, and in the World Series you hit .458 and mm-hmm. you stole home off Allie Reynolds. That had to be memorable.
Oh yeah, I had done it 5 times that year. And the secret, of course, was to get a big lead off third base. Take an extra foot or two. And he was taking a long time to deliver the ball home plate. So I saw that. And I whispered to Leo DeRozier, who was coaching third base. I said, Leo, I think I can make it. He said, well, get an extra step. Take an extra step and go ahead. And I slid in right right over Yogi Berra's tag. And when the umpire said, safe, Yogi said, no. I said, yeah, yo. He said, how do you know? I said, you'll see it tomorrow on the front page of the Daily News and the Daily Mirror. And sure enough, there it was.
And I bet every time you've seen Yogi since then, you've reminded him of that.
That's right. Yeah. He said, I hadn't seen him for about 25 years. I knew he was coaching and managing and so on. So we were on the Veterans Committee together, and I saw him when he came in. I said, Yogi, hey, come on over and have a cup of coffee with me. So he came over. You know what he said? He said, you were safe, money, in 51. He said, but Jackie was out in 55. That's Yogi for you.
Absolutely. We could spend a whole hour talking about him.
That's true.
Now, you guys did not win the 1951 World Series.
Yeah, we had a bad break. Our best hitter was Don Mueller, a right fielder.
Yeah.
He sprained his ankle severely, sliding into third base. And then the Sunday that the Yankees didn't have a pitcher, it rained and gave Allie Reynolds an extra day's rest, and he came back to beat us. But we were still happy because we'd won the pennant. Nobody expected us to do that. It was just one of those things that we were hoping for, and it really happened.
Well, and 3 years later, you would get your moment, and
mm-hmm.
everyone remembers the basket catch at the Polo Grounds that Mr. Mays had. And,
I've heard
that you looked at Willie Mays and mm-hmm. saw yourself as a younger man.
Yeah, he was a fine youngster, a natural, of course. Couldn't teach him anything because he knew just about everything. He was a finished ball player already when he came to us. He was a diamond in the rough. All we had to do was kind of polish him up a little bit, and in a half a year he was polished. And of course, he made that great catch. And on the way in, I said, after we got the other out, I said, Rumi, I didn't think you'd get there. He said, you kidding? He said, I had it all the way. I said, you did, huh?
Yeah. What when you guys finished that off and took care of the Indians and had that World Championship, was mm-hmm. did it mean as much as you thought it would?
Yeah, it meant a whole lot because we didn't quite make it in 51, but in 54 we had acquired Johnny Antonelli and Dusty Rhodes and another pitcher, and so we were a complete team, and we knew that we could beat them because in spring training, they spring trained in Tucson, and our training camp was in Phoenix. So we used to play each other all the time. So we knew that we could beat them. But if Willie hadn't made the catch, they might have beat us 4 in a row. I can safely say that.
I think Vic Wertz would certainly say that.
Yes, he would. That's true. Mm-hmm.
So you won the World Series in 54. Is it hard to believe now, 56 years later, as you watch the Giants in a pennant race again, that the Giants have not won another World Series since you guys did in 54?
That's true. They came close, but maybe this might be their year. They have great pitching. They still need a couple of power hitters. Maybe by next year they'll be able to sign somebody. But I'm rooting for them, and I hope they make it. Hope they can go all the way.
What was it like for you just a few months back to fly out to San Francisco to see everybody on their feet and to see your number 20 retired by that club?
Well, it was a great honor. I'll always be eternally grateful for the Giants for what they did. My family and I, we flew out there, and they treated us royally for 3 or 4 days. Put us up in a wonderful hotel. We had a terrific luncheon. I got a chance to revisit with Mays and McCovey and Marichal and Cepeda and Gaylord Perry. They were there. So it was a happy time. And my daughter and the rest of my family said, we'll always go back. They call me Papa. We'll always go back even after you've gone. I said, please do.
Well, not that you're in a hurry to go anywhere.
Not in a hurry.
Our listeners can tell how sharp you are at 91, going to be 92 in February.
Mm-hmm.
And another day I have to ask you about.
Yes.
In 1973 in Cooperstown, I imagine when you were playing as Jimmy Nelson, or when you were overseas in a foxhole, not knowing if you'd ever see your wife or daughter again, mm-hmm. you couldn't have imagined having your face on a wall in the Baseball Hall of Fame. What did that mean to you, and what did you think of when you accepted that great honor?
Well, it meant everything, of course. Number one, it's something that I didn't expect. I didn't, you know, ever know of a great thing like that would happen. But I told them that how grateful I was, how many thrills I've had and so on. But receiving that honor with the rest of those wonderful Hall of Famers sitting behind me meant everything in the world to me, and I told them that.
Now, you have a reputation around baseball as one of the classiest guys to ever play the game and someone who's real humble, and I think our listeners have picked up on that. And I absolutely love the title of your first book that you wrote a few years ago now. But, of course, your manager, the New York Giants, was famous for a quote that's been repeated
yep.
for years and years.
Yep. I told Leo, I said, you had it one way, Leo. I said, I'm going to do it the other way.
And he said, nice guys finish last.
Finish first.
So the title of your book is?
Nice guys finish first.
And mm-hmm. and what was the point behind that? What did you try to convey with that
message? That you can still be, you know, Leo would do anything to win. I wanted to do the right thing and still win, you know, leave a wonderful legacy, you know, winning the right way.
When you look back now at mm-hmm. everything you've been able to experience in 91 years, your time in the military, your time in baseball, certainly mm-hmm. your family and everything you've been blessed with, mm-hmm. is there one thing that you're most proud of that means the most to you that you want to be remembered for the most?
Well, I want to be remembered as someone who came up late but did the very best I could do under very trying circumstances. I tried to make it better for those who came after me. I tried to show some class wherever I could. And more than anything else, my father told me, he said, Monty, all you have to do is treat people the way you want to be treated and live by the golden rule, and you'll be okay. So that's the legacy I'd like to leave.
Well, I don't think anybody could say it any better than that. I know that we've talked so much baseball in this time and not that much about your time in the military,
mm-hmm.
and for good reason. You had some pretty exciting things that you experienced in
You're
baseball.
You're so right.
Is there anything else about your time in the service that maybe a lesson you learned from that you applied later on or something that you carry with you today about the men that you served with and what they were all about?
Well, I don't know anyone that's still alive. I hope some of them are. You know, we had to stick together on the very trying times, and we met some wonderful people. We tried to help them. We did what we were told to do, and we hope that somebody appreciated the effort that we made. That's what I want to say finally.
And did I interpret correctly when you talked about that you and other African-American veterans of the war who came back felt like what you did overseas and what you proved in doing so had a big role in your access eventually to Major League Baseball?
Yeah. I think what we did helped the cause, and again, I think it made it a little easier. They realized if given a chance, we could do it just as good as anybody else.
Well, I think you said some wonderful things today. It's been a privilege sharing this time with you. Thanks so much for giving all that time. Is there anything else that you'd like to share with our audience?
Well, I just want to say hello to everybody and wish them the very best of luck. And remember, treat people the way you want to be treated.
Amen to that. Well,
okay,
Monty,
Paul,
thank you so much for serving our country, for making baseball proud, and get the Giants in the World Series for us if you
I
can.
I hope so, yeah. And if they do win, I'm going out there.
Oh, we'll be looking for you then.
All right. Take care.
Thank you so much.
Okay.
That's Monty Irvin, 91 years old, a veteran of World War II, a baseball Hall of Famer. And we'll be back next week with another tie to that shot heard around the world right here in the San Joaquin Valley. This has been Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.